on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 37 of our Planet Earth series, the series in which we look at our home planet. Well, the AIRS instrument is on the Aqua satellite, and its job is to, well, map out water vapor and carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. Well, this feature about it was written and produced and directed by Blaine Baggett. And it's narrated by Mike Meacham, a systems engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which produced this interesting feature about AIRS, A-I-R-S.
And for that idea, he found takers. Moose's instrument, called the Atmospheric Infrared Sounder, or AIRS, was one of six science instruments that won a spot to fly aboard NASA's Aqua satellite. AIRS was designed to detect infrared energy over a range of more than 2,000 wavelength bands. And from those bands, it was hoped, for AIRS was officially an experiment, that it would be possible to create 3D maps of atmospheric temperatures and water vapor. But before any of these measurements could be put to work, all of the raw data of zeros and ones first had to be calibrated and validated.
Once you have those numbers that you think represent reality, you have to confirm that they are reality. And this is one thing I did for the first 5 or so years of the mission, pretty much daily, including a lot of weekends, just looked at what AIRS said and what, say, a weather balloon said. Or what AIRS said and what an aircraft that flew underneath AIRS said. And with several years of hard work, we concluded we weren't crazy, that the numbers that we reported from the instrument were actually representative of reality.
And soon, AIRS began delivering on its promise. Its measurements were helping to improve weather forecasts.
That was said to be enough to pay for the instrument itself. So forecast really was a major accomplishment. But NASA's not a forecast center.
And Moose, always trying to make progress, next wanted to explore how AIRS might be put to use to better understand climate change.
As part of AIRS' original purpose of improving weather forecasting, the instrument had already gathered a wealth of data about water vapor, which is H2O in the form of an invisible gas. We know it best as humidity.
Water vapor is also a greenhouse gas. And there's more water vapor than all other greenhouse gases combined. But through the ages, the warmth provided by water vapor has been a good thing. Without it, our planet would be just a frozen ice cube. Water vapor is part of nature's normal recycling of water from the Earth's surface into the atmosphere and then back again to the surface. And this recycling goes on constantly, but on different timescales. A piece of ice in the Arctic can remain a solid for millions of years. A drop of water in the ocean, thousands of years. That same drop of water, in the form of water vapor in the atmosphere, on average, just 9 days. The amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is directly related to temperature. The warmer it is, the more water evaporates, becoming water vapor. And more water vapor results in warmer temperatures.
So you've got here a cycle. When you change the state of water from vapor to liquid, this change releases enormous amount of energy into the atmosphere. The understanding it is critical to understanding our climate change. This is why it is important.
At any one time, the atmosphere contains over 37 million billion gallons of water vapor, which contains an astonishing amount of energy. And all this water vapor doesn't disappear into thin air. It is constantly transforming back into water, ice, and snow, which rains down on us. Often in the form of storms that are becoming more frequent and more severe. But water vapor is not the driver of global warming. The main catalyst is carbon dioxide, CO2. And Moose wanted to tease out of the air's data the signature of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, which he nicknamed the culprit. But detecting CO2 from the data proved an enormously difficult task, what his team likened to unscrambling a scrambled egg.
So the problem here is looking at a set of data with the information you want, but the noise is so high that what you are looking for is within the noise. The unscrambling of a scrambled egg. That difficulty was thought of as unsurmountable.
But just 4 years after the launch of AIRS, the insurmountable was surmounted. The culprit, Moose declared, had been coaxed out of hiding.
We've done it. Now we are looking at climate.
This is the first global map showing the distribution of carbon dioxide around the world as seen from Earth orbit. It clearly shows a distinct pattern of high carbon dioxide in the northern hemisphere, which was consistent with predictions made by climate modelers. Methane, another greenhouse gas, is seen here having a global distribution similar to that of CO2. Here, carbon monoxide, which is not a greenhouse gas, can be seen being created by the burning of forests in the Amazon. The gas then makes its way across the Atlantic. Fires in Africa can also be seen. The map continues to be updated, all showing a constant increase of CO2. 20 years after being launched, the AIRS instrument onboard NASA's Aqua satellite is still operating, eyeing from Earth orbit not only greenhouse gases, but hurricanes, dust storms, wildfires, volcanoes, and of course, helping weather forecasts. It was a kind of progress Moose had always hoped to accomplish.
It is like having worked for an idea. And I had doubts, my colleagues had doubts, but 30 years later, the idea works. And this is the great sense of happiness, of satisfaction I get and my colleagues get out of AIRS, you know, that a concept that we worked on for 30 years worked and worked very well. This is great.
And that feature came courtesy of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth. Earth. Earth.
Two scientists at the University of Iowa have been studying the connection between reduced air pollution during the COVID-19 pandemic and sharp decreases in precipitation in the western United States. It is well known that moisture in the atmosphere condenses around aerosols and particles like dust and falls to Earth as rain and snow. Fewer aerosols during the pandemic may have been responsible for the reduced precipitation in early 2020 across the western United States. Some areas received less than half of normal rainfall. The scientists have used NASA satellite data on water vapor, precipitation, and aerosols to tell whether the changes are caused by COVID-19-related changes in aerosols or by natural variability in the climate system. Those scientists aren't the only ones looking at the effects of COVID. COVID lockdowns revealed human effects on our planet's atmosphere. The Goddard Space Flight Center scientists have been watching.
Recently, two separate NASA studies illustrated the complex relationship between human activity and our atmosphere. First up, a team led by scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory focused on drops in nitrogen oxide emissions during the COVID-19 lockdowns. Nitrogen oxide comes from sources like power plants and car exhaust and reacts to form surface-level ozone, which is harmful to human health. Using NASA satellites, the team saw that the lockdowns left a distinct fingerprint on ozone levels in the lower atmosphere, which dropped about 2% globally. And while this may seem small, such a drop in harmful ozone would take about 15 years to achieve under even the most aggressive emission control scenarios. Interestingly enough, the team found that these drops were not uniform across the globe, that where and when the lockdowns occurred was very important in determining the impact on the atmosphere. Taking a look at these regions, with blue representing below normal levels of ozone in the lower atmosphere, we could see that both Asia and the United States have a substantial impact on harmful global ozone levels. Factors like prevailing winds, air temperature, and moisture content all impact how efficiently ozone is produced and moves throughout the globe. Like ozone, CO2 is a long-lived gas that is easily transported through the atmosphere, which means that any changes in emissions is mixed with many different influences from both near and far. This makes it challenging to track and measure how local changes in human activity actually impact the levels of this greenhouse gas. Using NASA's OCO2 instrument and the GEOS model, NASA researchers were able to spot short-term regional fluctuations in the atmosphere due to drops in human activity related to the lockdowns. This is the first time changes in CO2 measurements have been tracked at such a scale all over the globe. The team's results showed that the CO2 emissions dropped significantly in the Northern Hemisphere from February through May and rebounded during the summer when some restrictions eased. The team was also able to better distinguish which monthly CO2 fluctuations were due to human activities and which were due to natural causes, like the Australian wildfires and ocean circulation patterns. This is important because distinguishing between human and natural causes is a critical step towards measuring human activity's collective effects on CO2 emissions in near real time. The lockdowns surrounding COVID-19 were an unprecedented global event that highlighted the complex relationships between emissions and the atmosphere. By studying these relationships, we can gain insights that could help us better design sustainable measures that can improve both human health and the climate.
This is the Space Show.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth.
The NASA Satellite Orbiting Carbon Observatory is often referred to by its acronym, OCO 2, or OCO 2. Recently, it was able to pinpoint the cause of a spike in atmospheric carbon dioxide that set records in its concentration. Anne-Marie Eldering, who works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, is the deputy project scientist for the OCO 2 mission. She recorded these comments about what was found and what the purpose of the OCO 2 satellite is.
Our big discovery was how the tropical land responded to El Nino and released extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And this is really important because as we try to predict the future and how the world will be under more warmth and drought, the El Nino indicates the direction. We'll have more carbon in the atmosphere. The reason we did the Orbiting Carbon Observatory mission was to understand more about how different areas of the world release and take up carbon dioxide. And a question is, in the future, what might happen? Well, El Nino and the heat and the drought is a lot like conditions we expect to have in the future. So this gives us a clue about how the plants might respond to more heat and more drought. Why are we studying atmospheric carbon dioxide? It's one of the most important gases to regulate Earth's temperature. Carbon dioxide acts like a blanket. It traps some of the heat that's being released from Earth. And it keeps us at a temperature that we could never be at without that blanket of gases. But as you put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it traps more and more heat. So we already have evidence of rising temperatures due to this extra carbon dioxide. And if we keep adding more, temperatures just keep going up. For me as a scientist, I mean, collecting the OCO2 data has really opened my eyes to how the world breathes. We knew we have seasonal cycles and that the carbon dioxide concentrations go up in the winter and down in the summer, but we never had a very good picture of it. When we looked at some of our first maps of carbon dioxide over late winter into spring and summer, it's amazing how fast plants turn on and take that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
The third orbiting carbon observatory is not a free-flying satellite like OCO 2. Instead, it is attached to the International Space Station. This feature has comments by Mac Bennett, the project system engineer, Anne-Marie Eldering, the project scientist, and Ralph Basilio, the project manager. All of them come from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
OCO3's job is to measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and how it's changing with time. So we'll look at how that's changing with different seasons. We'll look how that's changing with the different areas. We'll look at places like urban areas where we expect to be a large source of carbon dioxide. And we'll also look at things like boreal forests or also the ocean, which actually breathe in carbon dioxide. The pointing mechanism on OCO3 is called the pointing mirror assembly. And the instrument field of view, what it actually sees on the ground, is very narrow. It's almost like looking through a straw. So if you were just to look straight down, you wouldn't get to see very much. So what the pointing mechanism allows us to do is scan back and forth over a large area, and then we can get the carbon dioxide state over Los Angeles Basin, for example, in one pass.
OCO3 is going to measure carbon dioxide from space, so this gas that's in our atmosphere, and also measures something we call solar-induced fluorescence. And when plants are doing photosynthesis, they let off a little light, and we measure that so we can see a signal of photosynthesis. All sorts of scientists are interested in this. You can imagine folks who look at crops or have a forest that they've been studying. They want us to get a little map and look at the details. We have folks who study volcanoes and like, hey, can you look at the volcanoes? Maybe we'll see a carbon dioxide plume. And of course, people who study human emissions want to look at cities and other places where there are intense carbon dioxide emissions. Over just 2 minutes, we can gather a map about 50 miles by 50 miles with footprints, each of them about a mile by a mile. So we'll get this little snapshot map and look at the details of carbon dioxide with this pointing system that we have on OCO3.
OCO3. Will measure atmospheric carbon dioxide. So measuring data consistent with the carbon cycle helps us to better understand the Earth as a system and how it is changing. And also better understanding the carbon cycle will help us to better determine how it's related to other global processes that are driving the climate change. I think one of the neat things is that OCO3 is going to operate in conjunction with two other NASA instruments that are already operating on the International Space Station. So that's EcoStress and JEDI. So the trio of instruments will actually produce this superset of data or information that will provide data for scientific research and informed decision making and also data applications.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena has teamed up with a non-profit organization called Carbon Mapper to develop a satellite instrument that will be able to pinpoint and measure methane and carbon dioxide sources. The data collected by the instrument will help find super emitters. These are the small percentage of individual sources that are responsible for a significant fraction of global emissions of methane and carbon dioxide. The first Carbon Mapper satellite is being built for a launch next year. The instrument is an imaging spectrometer, and this separates light into hundreds of colors to reveal the unique spectral signature of molecules in the air. Similar imaging spectrometers will soon be aboard upcoming missions to the Moon and Jupiter's moon, Europa.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Gavin Schmidt is the acting senior climate advisor at NASA. He was interviewed by the public affairs people at the Goddard Space Flight Center about his role and what NASA's doing. And I'm going to read the questions here in the studio, but Gavin Schmidt will answer. So the first question they posed was, what is NASA's connection to Earth Day?
NASA has been observing the Earth since the beginning of the satellite era in the 1960s. And the data that we are bringing down on all sorts of variables, from the ozone layer to temperature to clouds to sea ice and gravity, they're all informing us about what is happening in climate on Earth. And NASA is a huge part of that.
What are some of the missions and instruments on the International Space Station?
Well, the International Space Station is a marvelous platform for observing things that are happening on Earth, but also in space. We're tracking things like the atmospheric distribution of carbon dioxide. We're tracking the stress on ecosystems and vegetation. We're also keeping track of how bright the sun is at any one moment and how that's affecting the Earth's climate too.
And what has studying Earth from space taught us about climate change?
The first views that we had from space of the Earth were transformative, both for the original Earth Day, but also for the people that saw it and then the people who've come to be working on it since then. Seeing the complexity of the Earth system and its uniqueness in the cosmos, as far as we can tell, has been profoundly important for many, many of the scientists working on this. And that extra viewpoint is something. It changes your perspective in a very literal way.
How does climate change impact hurricane and cyclone trends?
So climate change is impacting hurricanes in a number of different ways. It looks like it's extending the season for hurricanes because the temperatures in the ocean, in the Atlantic Ocean, are warmer for longer because of the increase in greenhouse gases. We're seeing greater intensity of precipitation so that when it rains harder. And we're seeing some signs that landfalling hurricanes are slowing down, which means that their rain is falling in a more concentrated area, and that's causing big problems, such as in the case of Hurricane Harvey over Houston a couple of years ago.
And how does climate change impact bushfires? That's what you call wildfires in North America.
So climate change is impacting wildfires in a number of ways. One is it's drying out the land. When there is fuel to burn, it's more flammable. And combined with other things that we're doing in terms of forest management, we are increasing the intensity of wildfires across the continent.
And how does climate change impact sea level?
Climate change impacts sea level in a number of different ways. The first and easiest to understand is that as the planet warms, the ocean absorbs that heat, and that's causing the ocean to expand. So that fills the basins more and more. But of course, as we're warming, we're also melting ice. We're melting ice in mountain areas. Glaciers are retreating. All of that water is effectively ending up in the ocean. We're melting ice in Greenland and particular West Antarctica, and those changes in ice mass, where you have ice that's sitting on the land, that's going into the ocean, and that's raising sea level as well. And so the rate of change of sea level that we've seen over the last 100 years is accelerating because of these additional aspects of climate change.
And does climate change have any impact on floods and droughts?
Climate change is impacting droughts possibly because of changes in the patterns of rainfall, but more directly because the planet is hotter, there's more of an evaporative demand. And so when there are shortages of rain, what's happening is that the soils are drying out faster, and so that the droughts are becoming more severe than they otherwise would be. The converse, the impact on floods, is also complicated, but because of the greater intensity of precipitation, so more rain when it's raining, that can cause flood situations to increase.
Landsat satellites have been observing the Earth since 1972. What can we see with Landsat?
Landsat is the longest-running set of missions that NASA has been looking at, and that really it's been looking at the surface changes on Earth going back for many decades now, and we're just about to launch another satellite in that series jointly with USGS to continue that long-term monitoring of the Earth's surface. And the things that you can see from that are changes in ecosystems, changes in coastlines, changes in glaciers. Everything that's happening on the surface of the Earth is being captured by this series of satellites. And a lot of it is related to climate change, and a lot of it is related to human activity more generally. And it's really quite amazing to see these things put together. Some of you may have seen there's a Google time-lapse app that was just launched that uses this information. Anywhere on Earth, you can see, 40 years of change in that Earth's surface.
Thank you, Gavin. And that was Gavin Schmidt, the Acting Senior Climate Advisor at NASA. Questions were posed by the folks at the Goddard Space Flight Center.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
We have been looking at planet Earth and, well, most of us just do it from the ground, but a little over 600 people have had the advantage of being able to look down on our planet. The rest of us do it vicariously by looking at some of these satellite images and data. Well, Reisman is an astronaut, and he has viewed the Earth from way, way up there.
Before I got ready to launch, I had looked at pictures on social media and pictures in NASA archives of the Earth so many times, I actually started to get worried. What if I get up there and it's just like the pictures? I mean, that's going to be weird if that's the thing where I'm like, oh, it looks just like the pictures. I'm ready to go home now. And then on the Soyuz, when I first got a chance to look out my little window at the Earth, there's something about looking out a round window at the curvature of the Earth that makes it just more pronounced and really makes it have a huge impact. And I just had this feeling like I was way up high looking down, and we were over the ocean, and the blues that I saw, it was ridiculous. I'd never imagined in my entire life getting to see something that beautiful. It was so foreign for the human mind to look at that, to see that total black of space, to see the Earth highlighted that way. And then I got to see a sunset. I had one piece of paper. It had a picture of my kids on it and a few of my flight data file burn times on it. But I just took a pencil and I drew 15 curved lines, and I just wrote light blue, darker blue, pink, purple, dark, dark purple, all the way down to the surface of the Earth at sunset, because the scale of looking at a sun refracting through the atmosphere, it blew me away. And no picture captures that. There's no high enough dynamic range of a photo to capture what the human can see.
And Nicole Stott has also seen our planet from up above.
I like to think of how people felt when they saw that Earthrise image from 1968 with the Apollo 8 crew. I mean, that was life-changing for humanity, really. And I want us to get back to that. This view of Earth is kind of ubiquitous these days. We open up Google Earth, and the first thing you see is a planet, which I think is awesome, because everybody has to look at it and say, oh, there's a planet, and then I have to zoom in to wherever it is I want to find or that I'm looking for on that planet. You can make a connection to it that way. I just had the 10th anniversary of my first space flight, which I can hardly believe. And I think you start to reflect a little bit differently on what you experienced. For me, that has come down to three simple facts: that we live on a planet, that we're all Earthlings, and, you know, that really and truly the only border that matters is this thin blue line of atmosphere that blankets and protects us all. And I think those three things for me have become not just a description of what I experienced in space, but they've become integral to my life. There is not a day goes by that I'm not thinking about those three things in one way or another. I think it's a very powerful way of considering how we live our lives, how we treat each other, and how we treat the life support system that surrounds us.
The views of astronaut Nicole Stott. This has been The Space Show.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth. Earth. Earth.
And we expect to have more about Planet Earth coming up in a future space show, perhaps even next week. And a reminder that the space show is on air every Wednesday between 7 and 8 p.m. I'm Andrew Rennie, and I look forward to sharing with you the excitement of space exploration coming up every Wednesday at 7 o'clock.